Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
So I had an interesting opportunity the other week to talk to the Chamber of Commerce at St. Cloud.
Okay, so how did that go?
It went very well. Chambers of Commerce are always interesting because you have a collection of many of the business leaders in a community, all of whom have their own businesses and who are, in some cases, very interested in hearing about yours.
So now that we're moving to Osceola County, we're going to be one of the new businesses in the area. So was this a good chance to hobnob with the other businesses?
It was, particularly because Osceola County is such an interesting county in terms of its growth trajectory. It was very important that we had the chance to talk with some of the other business leaders there about some of the challenges that they face, as well as give them a chance to get an understanding of what our business model is like.
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that because, you know, when I think of Osceola County, I think a lot of it is being not so populated and not so intense with businesses. So you mentioned the business trajectory being interesting there. So I'm curious, what do you mean by that?
Well, Osceola County is a great deal of flux at the moment. It is really comprised of two major economic centers. There's the city of Kissimmee, of course, which houses a lot of the theme parks and has a lot of the resources that they use. Then we've got St. Cloud, which is actually far more proximal to Lake Nona. And for those who are not local to the area, Lake Nona is an area of Orange County that was largely undeveloped until the decision was made to put a medical city out there. So there has been a lot of money that has been spent in putting in infrastructure and building not only new hospitals and new upscale medical facilities, but also the medical school for the University of Central Florida.
And that's actually in Orange County, though, correct?
Right. It's right in Orange County, but because of where they put it in Orange County, it shares a very, very close border with Osceola, just to the north.
And it's obviously affecting the finances and different commercial aspects of St. Cloud?
It is. St. Cloud as a city, it's a wonderful town. It is got a small town feel to it where a lot of people do know each other, but it's large enough such that there are still amenities and things to do, and you don't necessarily have your neighbors right on top of you.
So it's still pretty spread out there.
It is. Osceola County, because of its rural roots, there is still a great deal of ranch land that's out there. So agriculture is a really big component of the Osceola County economics.
So what kind of businesses were represented at the meeting you went to?
Chambers of Commerce are membership institutions, of which we are a member as well. But the nature of the chamber is such that anyone who wants to do business there will join up with the Chamber of Commerce. So you may have a small business that does, say, embroidery or pet care or real estate agents. And then you may have large businesses such as Disney may want to be part of it or the Boy Scouts of America. And Osceola County, there are lots of nonprofit organizations that are part of their Chamber of Commerce.
Including CIFAR.
Including CIFAR.
So tell us a little bit more about the meeting you had then.
Quarterly, the Chamber of Commerce has a meeting where they give out various awards and everyone gets a chance to have a luncheon with a speaker. And they were kind enough to, shortly after we had joined up, to invite us over to have a speaker. And that got to be me.
Okay, so you gave them a speech.
really what I was trying to do in the 15 minutes that I was allotted was give the community a chance to get an idea on what CIFAR is, where we came from, what our future looks like, and what resources it's going to take for us to make that future happen.
So why don't we take a little time for you to explain that to our listeners then?
If you were sitting in the audience, then you would have gotten a chance to start with a little bit of a video. I always like to show pictures first, because when you talk about cats to people, cats for most people means small domestic cats. And it's funny because it tends to raise very strong feelings in people when you use the term cats. They have their impressions. Cats, you're very rarely on the fence about cats. It's not a give or take kind of thing. It's either people like cats or they don't, usually because a cat has either gotten along with them or hasn't.
Well, there's the allergy thing too.
There is the allergy thing, but most of the time people think domestic. So when we say cats as CIFAR, we have to sometimes make people realize that we're talking not just about big fat cats, we're talking about big cats like tigers and lions and cougars and leopards. And the best way to do that is usually to show them a little video, because it's unmistakable once you see a big cat. Then when you use the term cat afterwards, then people's minds jump to the right size frame.
And of course, now they've gotten the majesty of the big creatures you're talking about.
In a little bit of a sizzle reel, I guess, is the best description of it, where you have a lot of pictures and, you know, some fast-paced music, something to really get your attention, at which point then I can start to describe a little bit about the basic history of CIFAR. Most people don't realize that the company has been around for 18 years in one form or another. In that 18 years, we have been a 501c3 charity since 97. That has a lot of significance because, in spite of the fact that people may not have heard about us, we have been around, we have been fulfilling this mission for almost 20 years now, which gives a little bit more of an understanding of the longevity. We didn't just come out of nowhere to suddenly become this organization. So the next part of the presentation goes into a little bit about the fact that we are, of course, moving, and that we're moving secondary to a great need to expand, as well as, of course, the request by the Brevard Board of County Commissioners. And once we've established that we've existed for a while and that we're in the process of moving, trying to give people an understanding of what the organization is really like, kind of by the numbers. You know, you can't do business without talking numbers in some cases.
So you have some statistics for us then?
Statistics and facts, really.
Okay.
Because, you know, statistics can be manipulated. But what is. It is a fact that we have over 40 big cats. It is a fact that our population, it consists mostly of tigers. It is also a fact that based upon USDA data that was taken in 2014, we have the largest collection of tigers in the state of Florida. And giving an idea of that scale and that scope lets people know as well that this is a very serious operation. And this is not just a startup operation here, even though what we're trying to do at the new place will be a lot different than perhaps some of our previous activities.
Well, actually, just as a question, you mentioned that we have the largest collection of tigers in the state. I know that there are sanctuaries in the state that are larger than we are, so clearly they have other big cats, different kind of population of them?
Yes. Generally speaking, there are some sanctuaries that are larger just by sheer number of residents, and many times that is a population of small cats. So you'd get your servals and your caracals and your ocelots. And those small cats, while not only being a little bit less intensive to take care of, can grow a population very, very quickly. Or you'll have a sanctuary that is not limited just to cats. They may have wolves, for example, or wild dogs. Binturongs are actually a creature that you can find at a lot of sanctuaries as well.
So getting back to the talk that you gave at the Chamber of Commerce, so now you've given them enough of a taste to understand that clearly we're a large organization in the sense that we have a huge number of tigers, and the fact that we've been around for quite a while. So where do you go from there?
Well, we also want to let them know about the people of CIFAR as well. When you look at our roster, we have over 61 names that are on the roster in various states, whether they be officers and executives or whether they be volunteers, some who are more intermittent for events and some who are on leaves of absence or otherwise, but still part of the organization and supporting them in the ways that they can. When people realize that the organization has 61 people that are listed on the resource, that makes it a pretty big organization in some cases, especially considering that there are no paid volunteers. And with no paid staff, being able to say that we have a population of over 40 cats with no paid staff and have been successful at keeping this population for as many years as we have was actually an applaud-worthy statement.
Yes, it would be. Absolutely.
So giving people that idea, I then switched to a little bit of a different video. I wanted to introduce them to Cheyenne. Cheyenne is a cougar, and not only is she a Western cougar, but she also is one of the originating cats of the organization. So she has survived all the organization's iterations, and her age at 18 years makes her a remarkable cat because of what has happened throughout the course of her life.
So was Cheyenne one of the first that came to the facility to begin with?
Cheyenne was part of the original three, two cougars and a tiger. That was the start, the progenitus of CIFAR. And throughout many years and whatnot, she, at the time, and when she was born in 1996, could be a pet. However, now she's far older, her eyesight is failing her, and she certainly doesn't jump around like she used to, but she is considered a class one predator. Yet, if you give her a toy, or in this case, we gave her a pumpkin the other weekend, and she rolled around and had a good time with it, she hasn't really changed all that much, except for in our minds, collectively as a society, where she has literally gone from pet to dangerous apex predator in the course of her lifetime.
And what year did that change? That's actually a change in the law that happened, correct?
It is, and it's a change that's been happening gradually over time. She, at one point, was just able to be a pet. Then she was placed in what was considered the Class 3 animals, which are animals that are not quite as dangerous as the big apex predators, but still can cause some problems, and they still want people to be licensed to handle them. And then was recently moved into the true Class 1 animals. And I believe that took place around 2005 when they revamped the laws for ownership of big cats in a number of species. It was actually driven by the ownership of exotic snakes. However, at the time, it was something that they fixed as well.
Lots of changes in Cheyenne's lifetime, not only for how she is regarded in the society, but also for CIFAR itself.
When you talk about a cat who was around before the advent of Google, and now she can be Googled and found. If you look her up, you'll find her online. It is a remarkable amount of change that she's had to endure, and there's a remarkable amount of change that we've had to endure, of course, as an organization as well, as she moved from pet to predator. That meant that the organization had to do more and more with regards to how she was handled and how she was enclosed, for example. And that has things to do with what are the enclosure requirements, what are the reporting requirements, what are the inspection requirements. All of these elements to the business that most people who wouldn't be in this side of the industry may not actually know. So the audience found that a bit interesting.
Yes, I'm sure they did. In fact, I imagine some of them may have been a little concerned about that and how you take care to make sure that the residents are enclosed and safe.
Yes, and we took a moment at this point to talk about that as well, because it's important for people to recognize that there's only 20 states that outright ban the ownership of big cats. And so that means in all the other ones, there is some mechanism for people to get big cats, whether that be licensure, permits, or in some cases, no regulations whatsoever. And that is usually a surprise to people when they hear that. But we reassure them by letting them know that First Florida is one of those states that does require licensure, and that we maintain two licensures, both at the USDA level, which is a permit through the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, that's APHIS, and then also through Florida's Fish and Wildlife Commission that handles all wildlife in the state.
And we've talked a little bit about these kinds of things in previous shows as well, about how these kinds of organizations are out there to help safeguard the animals. But it's also been brought up many times that it's difficult for them to actually monitor everybody and make sure everyone's in line with everything.
Well, when it comes to the states that don't have the laws in place, then that's where it gets really challenging. And that's one of the contrasts that we draw with that, particularly for the business model. There are some mega sanctuaries that are out there that have hundreds and hundreds of animals. In fact, one sanctuary in Tennessee boasts having over 300 tigers alone. And that's a remarkable number to have. And when people think about business, oftentimes they think about business scale. How do you make it bigger? How do you grow your revenue? What are your revenue streams? Well, it's actually a bit counterintuitive when it comes to that with the big cats, because the big cats in and of themselves are not generally a revenue stream, i.e. just by them existing, they don't generate revenue, not by a unit or by a widget, which most businesses like to try and get things down to the functional widget. If you look at the cats, they don't really have that functional widget. They are truly an expense because they have to be fed, they have to be housed, their actions cause expense.
Well, obviously, that's one of the reasons why many sanctuaries have chosen to not breed animals, because all it's doing is adding expense to your facility.
If you can generate the same number of donations and interest from two cats, then it is far more business economical and makes far more business sense for you to have two cats instead of 20 cats.
Right. Now, you'll have more money to take care of those particular cats in general.
Your revenue per cat is actually higher if you have two cats. Now, I say two cats as an example, but functionally speaking, two cats is not generally enough to have the kind of draw that's necessary in order to generate that revenue, because two cats is a very small collection. But in order to have enough breadth and depth of personalities, as well as different species, such that you can really discuss the impact of different species, you need to have more. So some of the bigger sanctuaries, the more cats that they have, the larger and the longer and the more intensive that they can make tours, which is a functional widget. That is a revenue-generating activity.
Yes, but the difference between touring 300 cats versus 40 cats, I don't know that a person is going to really get an appreciable difference out of that to actually pay more money to do it.
And interestingly enough, the sanctuary mentioned that has the over 300 cats, they are not open to the public and don't do tours. They're completely private.
Okay.
So their revenue streams are not linked to the presence of cats at all.
That's interesting in itself, and yet they have so many.
Then there becomes the question of how. And we always get that question of, okay, well, is breeding a part of your operation? No, we don't breed the cats. And that was actually a point of comedy, because most people will ask that question, well, do you mate the cats?
So not me personally,
it's
right?
It's like, no, I don't mate the cats. I love them, but not like that.
Exactly.
And that being said, the intent of the question is, of course, do you breed the cats or allow the cats to breed? The answer for us is, of course, no. Businesses like flexibility. That's one thing that is common to just about any kind of business, because we are all subject to the nature of the economy, to changing attitudes. Cheyenne's a classic example. You know, she went from pet to predator. Not that she knew that. She didn't change anything. The organization didn't have to change anything, but the perception of her as a cougar has changed. And so the business needs to be able to adjust to those changing times so that the functional widget can continue to generate revenue and continue to allow the organization to exist. When it comes to the question of breeding, we had mentioned that USDA information. Well, if you look at the data that came out from 2004, it was estimated that there were roughly 4,800 cats in the country that the USDA knew about. And now we're looking at 2,500 in the country that the USDA knew about, or knows about, I should say. And that's a significant drop. In 10 years, we're talking about a 50% decline in the population that is being monitored.
Are you saying the population being monitored in sanctuaries alone or in any condition, like zoos, everything?
These are all the USDA cats. So that would include zoos, that includes private exhibitors, that includes anybody who has a permit to possess big cats. And there's a big caveat to that number. And part of that caveat is that there are some places that are not required to have USDA licensure. So all of those cats could be in private facilities that have just chosen not to get USDA licensed. Or we truly could have less tigers in the country than are left in the wild, because that number has fundamentally not changed. It's right around 3,200. And that's where it raises an interesting business challenge, because we have no current desire to do any breeding because it's not necessary. There's plenty of opportunities in rescue and relocating cats that need a better home. However, down the road, 10 years down the road, could be 20 years down the road, if the public pressures and the business challenges and whatnot start to cause a consolidation, or people choose not to get any further cats, which is what USDA actually showed had happened, especially with the bad economy, is people who had cats either got rid of them or their cats died and they never replaced them, then that means that the population is going to get a lot smaller and at some point may even bottleneck within the country. And it will be extremely important that sanctuaries, zoos, all of the organizations that still have cats left have the flexibility to help propagate the species.
Well, of course, the question there would be, what would be the end or gain for propagating the species when there's no chance you're going to release them to the wild?
A great question. It's the same challenge that they have with the cheetah, as a matter of fact, because in the wild, the numbers may drop to the point where they just can't do it anymore in the wild. And the situation in the wild still depends very heavily on the governments and localities where the cats exist getting their act together and having it together on a long-term permanent basis such that those populations can adequately thrive and survive. Now, we've had an interesting preview of what that could potentially look like and some of the problems that can come up with that with regards to the lions in the forest of Gir in India. What ended up happening was that they have been quite successful. Now, this is a critically endangered lion population, very, very small, less than 500. But as that population has grown, they have expanded and continued walking until eventually they either have run into fences because they are in a protected forest, or they are starting to actually get hit on roads because they are wandering across roads. And we're reaching a new equilibrium as the populations have been successful.
They were successful due to the creation of a preserve specifically for them?
And focused conservation efforts to give them a chance to really breed and get established in their territories. Now, that's a success story that has the potential to be a bit of a challenge because of the fact that they are big, they need to have space, and if they're successful, then their numbers are going to go up, which means that they need to have more space, and that space is continually being taken.
So there's obviously a point at which you reach maximum density.
Right. And contrast that with, let's say, another endangered species that came back from the brink, the bald eagle. Whereas the bald eagle was terribly endangered, but we're talking about a bird of prey, and this bird of prey has a lot more flexibility in terms of where they go because there are no fences where they tend to be. And they aren't really in direct competition with humans. So this is an endangered species that came back from the brink and is doing quite well. But no competition with humans, no land competition.
That's a different situation, clearly.
It is. And these are the elements that go into some of the decision-making that comes with how you're going to handle the larger conservation challenge, because regardless of whether or not you are or are not breeding as a business model, the conservation challenge is an inherent component to whether or not your business is going to survive.
How do you mean that the conservation challenge is part of your business surviving?
Well, every business is going to exist upon a spectrum of both interest and accessibility. So if you are going to start a business making burgers, for example, burgers are mid to low interest, high accessibility, which means that you're not going to have a lot of exclusivity to drive people towards your business. Your burger has to be absolutely stellar in order to take business away from the existing places. Now, contrast that with the cats. With the cats, they are a low accessibility, high interest commodity. So with that kind of matrix, that means that it doesn't take much for people to become phenomenally interested in what the cats are doing, even to the point where just having them on the TV telling somebody something mundane still results in a positive effect for the organization, as well as the people who are bringing them the story.
Okay, but again, how does that contrast with what you're saying is that conservation efforts would somehow be part of that business model?
So when you look at that interest and accessibility level, if conservation is extraordinarily successful, say bald eagle successful, at that point then the animals lose the degree of interest because the accessibility becomes very easy. Anybody can go and see a bald eagle. Anybody can go and see a tiger, let's say, which, you know, sounds foreign, but in the interest scale, just kind of, you know, go with that analogy. What that will do is that will require more expense, more capital expenditure, basically more investment in trying to make the cats that you have more interesting than the cats that someone else has, because the competition is a lot hotter.
And in some cases, that interest level is by having a cute little cub in your hands,
which is another business challenge that people face. And there are far too many places that have fallen into that trap, because cubs are easy. Cubs are cute. They are playful. They are engaging to watch. You know, you can watch them rolling around and everybody oohs and ahs, and people like their dose of cute. That's just the reality. But in a state like Florida, where the laws are so specific in terms of how long those cubs can actually be in contact with the public and at what point they no longer can be in contact with the public, building a business model around cubs is a death spiral, because that means that you're going to have to constantly have access to and be producing cubs in order to keep that going.
And obviously that's a failing business model, because you still have to take care of that cub once it's reached the point where it can no longer be taken into the public for generating revenue. You're still going to take care of that cub for maybe up to 18 years.
Well, CIFAR certainly would if we ever had cubs, but that's not a requirement based upon the law. At the point when they are quote unquote done with the cub, then they can dispense with it as they please.
Well, that's kind of a sad statement in itself. I'm hoping that means it goes to a sanctuary like CIFAR that would take care of them.
Yes. Yes, you are hoping that. And indeed, yeah. Indeed, we all hope that. But we do know that that is not always the case.
So there's no law against them actually just dispensing in the negative sense?
Well, dispensing in the negative sense has a number of different manners that can happen. They can basically call them refuse cubs, dump them into the sanctuary community. They can sell them to another agency that perhaps does things with larger cubs, whether it be mobile displays or entertainment venues. It is very much frowned upon, and I would venture to say pretty much illegal, to just put them down because they are no longer part of the business. However, we do know that stories like this certainly exist, where people have done horrible things and they found freezers full of cubs.
Oh, that's just sad. Actually, there was a story recently of a zoo, I believe it was in Denmark, that put down a lion specifically because they just didn't have room for a new one coming in.
Right. That was the one that we talked about that earlier this year.
Yeah.
And that is kind of the ugly side of things. If their business model depended on the fact that they had young, vibrant, fresh male lions that were oohing and eyeing their crowd, and they believed that that was their business model.
Correct.
Then the fact that they just put down a healthy but older adult just so that they could get a younger, more vibrant one, it was reprehensible then. It's still reprehensible now, even more so because other places did volunteer to take that lion and they refused to release him.
Yeah, that's the part that makes no sense to me, but in any case.
Well, when you look at the business model that we as CIFAR have, our business model is based around our care and maintenance of our cats and the mission of taking care of the cats that we have. So our widget is not necessarily tied to a number as much as it's tied to the fact that we do have cats. And when people do come on site, they can have a very highly educated guide who can walk them through the facility and give them insight into the world of the big cats.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CIFAR Sounding.